to the great movie ride. In just a few moments, these doors behind me will open and your journey into the movies will begin.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you could step as far forward and close together as you can.
Yeah. Get real close.
Okay, the director's ready. Talent's ready. Cue the opening.
WDW Radio. Your information station.
Hello, my friends, and welcome to the WDW Radio Show, your Walt Disney World information station. I am your host, Lou Mangiello, and this is show number 329 for the week of July 7th, 2013. I'm here to help you have the best possible Disney vacation experience and bring you a little bit of Disney magic wherever you are with this podcast, as well as my new Disney in a Minute videos, blog, live broadcasts, special events, my Walt Disney World trivia books, audio tour CDs, and more. You can find everything over at wdwradio.com. This week's episode is brought to you by audible.com, where you can get a free audiobook download at audibletrial.com/wdwradio. There are tons of books available for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or any MP3 player, including lots of Disney books like the Kingdom Keeper series, Neil Gabler's Walt Disney biography, and much more. Again, you can sign up for free at audibletrial.com/wdwradio. We're going to visit Disney's Hollywood Studios this week and take a close look at the history, stories, and secrets of the great movie ride. We'll explore not just how it came to be, its changes and details, but virtually visit each scene and also discuss what we would change and why, and then ask you to do the same. I'll then have the answer to our last Walt Disney World trivia question of the week and pose a new challenge for your chance to win a Disney prize package. Then stay tuned for some announcements, including information about our upcoming e-ticket event weekend. I'll then play more of your voicemails at the end of the show. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this week's episode of the WDW Radio Show. So many attractions in Walt Disney World have interesting stories about how they came to be, from those that had their origins out in Disneyland to others that were inspired by movies or folklore or fake lore, history or cultures from around the world, or maybe our thirst for adventure and excitement. But only one, I think, can claim that it was born from something much grander, which was its own theme park. And of course, I'm talking about the Great Movie Ride, whose genesis came not from the studios, but from a concept from a park whose focus is on the future. So today, in this DSI Disney Scene Investigation, we're going to talk about how the Great Movie Ride came to be and why, as well as many more of its stories and details and secrets, maybe a few fun facts you may not have known before, to help you give a new appreciation of this iconic attraction. And joining me this week is a man who knows that this job is perfect for him because he loves the movies. He's an author, Disney historian, magician, storyteller extraordinaire, and a fan of musical extravaganzas. He is, of course, Jim Corcus.
Well, thank you so much, Lou. Again, always a pleasure. And to all of you listening, thank you very much. Hooray for Hollywood. And of course, this is the perfect topic for this week, because those of you who follow along know that Lou has lost so much weight, he looks like a movie star. and so I would suggest that you go to the shop section at WDW Radio so that you buy that Lou Mangiello miracle diet powder that you mix with Italian pasta. And you too can look like a young movie star, and in fact go and take a look at the shop section. I think a lot of you forget that. I was up in Dayton, Ohio, at their Disneyana event last week, and this very charming 24-year-old young lady named Kim came up to purchase a book and get it autographed, and she said how much she loved hearing me on Lou's broadcast. And I said, but gee, you're wearing a T-shirt. If you love Lou so much, she says, well, does he sell T-shirts? Yes, he does. And he sells even more. And so Kim, I'm telling you right now, I know you listen to other podcasts. When you're listening to this podcast, write in to Lou. I will pay for you to have a WDW Radio T-shirt. So when you're wandering out there in Michigan, people will know what they should be listening to. But, you know, a great movie ride is such a terrific attraction. I love it. I love the original one before things stopped working that was there in 1989. But Lou, you alluded to something that Great Movie Ride actually got its start somewhere else, right?
Exactly. But let's touch on that for a second, right? It's sort of our love of the Great Movie Ride. Is it more nostalgic? Do we still love this attraction? Is it a must-do for you? Or, you know, when you go to the studios, is the Great Movie Ride something that you do every time? And is it more because you love the attraction so much, or is it a sense of nostalgia for you?
Well, I'm going to answer right now that I'm of that generation that grew up watching these old movies on TV with my mom and dad and just absolutely, you know, fell in love with them. But I am also familiar with the fact that we have a generation or two generations that don't know any of these films. If you went up to someone and said Footlight Parade, you know, they might say, oh, isn't that something in the Great Movie Ride, as opposed to, my gosh, this was a magnificent Busby Berkeley film and it transformed how dances and musical numbers were staged. And again, Disney is always looking to change. Here's a little secret just for listeners of WDW Radio. The alien section was going to be removed, and it was going to be removed and replaced because, believe it or not, Disney was in negotiations with Peter Jackson for Lord of the Rings. So there was going to be a Lord of the Rings scene in the Great Movie Ride. However, negotiations fell apart, and Jackson is taking Lord of the Rings, and it's going to Universal. But the Great Movie Ride, there could have been an updated scene. And so I think the other question Lou should be asking is not, is this nostalgic or whatever, but can the Great Movie Ride be enhanced or saved by having some updated scenes in there rather than these wonderful classics that I love but people are unfamiliar with?
Right. And that's, you know, you mentioned Great Movie Ride, and the conversation automatically turns to, it needs to change. How do you change? What movies do you put in? How do you represent certain genres? And I think at the end of the segment, we should talk about that. Maybe sort of we'll play Imagineer for a day and let listeners do the same thing. Because I think you're right. As you go through iconic films, Mary Poppins, Indiana Jones, maybe Tarzan, you know, but you go to the underworld scene.
You know, Mary Poppins is 50 years old
I know.
Next year.
Right. But you go to the underworld scene. You say Little Caesar, people think Pizza Pizza. They don't think Edward G. Robinson.
That's very true. That's very, very true. Or you say Scarface, and you don't think about the classic Warner Brothers film from the 40s. You think about the Al Pacino, Say Hello to My Little Friend.
Right, right. So, well, let's get to that as we go through.
Let's start at the beginning. You know, you alluded to this, that it was actually going to be a pavilion. Marty Sklar worked on it, and Randy Bright did, and even Ward Kimball, that there was going to be a pavilion between Imagination and the land. And so there's going to be this huge building, but you wouldn't have seen a huge building because it would have been painted. So it looked like the sky, so it blended into the sky. And down at the bottom is a very small theater marquee. I think it was red and gold. And you walk through the door of that marquee, and then suddenly you're in the pavilion building. And there was going to be an attraction called Great Movie Moments, or Great Moments at the Movies. There were variations of that. And there was also going to be a dark ride, a traditional dark ride designed by Ward Kimball, where you would go through the making of a 1930s Mickey Mouse cartoon. But again, it would be a wild, crazy cartoon studio, so when you were in the animation section, whatever. And so it was going to start life as a pavilion at Epcot.
And it's interesting when you talked about what the exterior was going to look like, very different from the grand theater that we have now. It was very much made to look fake, right? It sort of embraced how fake Hollywood is. It looked just like, you know, a square painted backdrop, and you almost sort of didn't know what you would see once you got inside.
Absolutely. And again, that was part of the thing, is the illusion of the movies. You know, what is real, what is not real, and you're you would be stepping into the movies, which was a concept that carried over when it was finally opened at Disney MGM.
Right, and I think, too, the name that you have to associate with this is one, and I seem to find myself almost accidentally defending it, because when you say the name Michael Eisner, people roll their eyes, right? You always remember the bad stuff. You always remember how he left. You don't remember that it was he who said, hey, there's enough here, not just for a single attraction, but enough to create an entire theme park around it based on Hollywood, based on show business as a whole, constructed sort of around this center. You know, this was sort of the hub of what was going to be the studios.
Yes, and a lot of people forget how magnificent Great Movie Ride was, because there were plans for it at three different locations out in California. Originally, it was going. There were plans for a Disney MGM studios right next to the Burbank studios out there, and the centerpiece was going to be the Great Movie Ride. And a little while ago, we talked about Roger Rabbit, and that at Disneyland for the Disney Decade, they were going to have that Hollywoodland running parallel right behind Main Street, and there'd be a Roger Rabbit section. But the Great Movie Ride was also going to be there. And a lot of people forget that original plans for Disney California Adventure is the Great Movie Ride was going to be a centerpiece in that Hollywood backlot studio.
Yeah, and the, you know, sort of making this the center icon, I think it helped to sort of define the aesthetics of what this, and look, we've done a full episode where we've basically walked down Hollywood Boulevard and walked down Sunset Boulevard. I'll link to it in the show notes, because rather than, they sort of divide the park into, yeah, part of it looks like a studio light, like that typical California backlot tour, but they really embrace the Hollywood of the 20s and the 40s and those landmarks that you see in the shops and the restaurants, you know, from the eateries to the pharmacies to that sort of very kitschy California crazy design. I think the Great Movie Ride and the theater really helped to define what the studio itself ended up looking like.
Yeah, and in fact, one of the reasons that Disney Hollywood Studios is one of my favorite Disney theme parks is it's very similar to Disneyland. Do you know that the length from the at Disney MGM Studio, Disney Hollywood Studios, from the turnstiles to Grauman's Chinese Theater is exactly the same length as at Disneyland coming in and from the train station walking down to the castle? And the castle, of course, at Disney MGM Studios was Grauman's Chinese Theater, and it wasn't. It wasn't, you know, oh, well, we're using false perspective and we're using, you know, a percentage. It was full size. Mm-hmm. They pulled out the actual blueprints for Grauman's Chinese Theater. In fact, the roof had to be built separately and then with a crane put on top of that. It is, and in fact, not only, now I'm so excited. They added in details from the theater in the 30s and 40s that had been removed by the 80s. And of course, by the 80s, it had been purchased by Mann Theater, so it was called Mann's Chinese Theater. And then later it went back to being Grauman's Chinese Theater, referring to Sid Grauman, who operated that theater. And then, of course, in the 90s, late 90s, Grauman's Chinese Theater got really upset with Disney, and they said, "Look, you're doing the handprints in the forecourt. You've got this. You're using this on postcards and as an icon, and that's destroying some of the value that we have, the uniqueness for this theater. And so that's why today, it take a look at the guidebooks and all that. It's just called the Chinese Theater, not Grauman's Chinese Theater anymore." And it's also one of the reasons that they stopped doing the handprint ceremony in front there. And some people claim it's also one of the contributing reasons that we get that architecturally magnificent hat in front of it there. But yes, but originally, 1989, you stepped in and you're going down Hollywood Boulevard just like you're going down Main Street USA, and you're going to the castle in the right. distance. But that castle is that it really is a castle. It's a movie palace. It's one of the best known movie palaces in the world. Just loved it.
And it was a beautiful view. You're right. And we forget how that looks, and people can debate their love or dislike of the hat. We understand why it's there. Let the lawyers come in, and next thing you know, you've got a giant hat in front of this magnificent theater. And it is. It is magnificent. And I think you made a great point about how it wasn't the theater in 1989. It was the theater in the 20s and the 30s, that vintage reference material that they used to keep it in that look, to sort of bring you back in time to the 20s and 30s and 40s.
Yeah, absolutely. The only major difference is the ticket booth in Florida here is moved over to the side. It's moved over to the left as you're facing the building, so that people get that clear view right into the entrance. I also like the fact that those two glass display cases outside showcase two Disney animated films that premiered there, Mary Poppins and Jungle Book. And so that's nice to see, those tickets and all that. But my gosh, this was the place to be. And I see guests go and try and put their handprints in the handprints of the celebrities who put them there, just as they do at... I'm a California boy, so I grew up going to Grauman's Chinese Theater. I put my foot in those prints and my hands and all that. And then I was told that oftentimes actors would wear larger shoes before they put in their things, and actresses would wear smaller shoes, would literally squeeze their feet into smaller shoes to get in there.
And it's... it's one of those things, Jim, I think that we see so many people often just run through, right? A lot of people maybe they don't look down, they don't care, they want to just get into the attraction, because there are some great details, and I'm happy you mentioned things like the windows, but much like the original theater, the two traditional food dogs are outside, and if you look at the building, look at the dragon, right? The typical Chinese dragon situation. I'll bet you how many people don't know that there is that water sculpture outside off to the left-hand side as well.
Yeah, no, you're right on the mark, Lou. And again, people need to remember too that these are red dragons. So, in Chinese culture, these are good luck, for all of this. And so, there's all that wonderful little detailing. But I think you're right. I think FastPass has a lot to do with this nowadays too, or just the nature of the culture nowadays. Immediate satisfaction still takes too long. You've got to rush to this and rush to that and rush to the other thing. And one of the things that I always love about being on your show is that you do remind the listeners that they should look around, look up, look down, look around the corners. One of the things that they would see is there's that little plaque up there that said Grauman's Chinese Theater opened in 1928. And the first time I saw that, I was shocked and appalled. No, I know it's 1927. It wasn't even towards the end of 1927. It's the middle of 1927. How could they possibly... And you know the story behind that, right, Lou?
Right.
The 1928 represents...
So this is one of the things that people talk about a lot, you know, that Disney made a mistake, you know, 1928. Or they put 1928 there because it has something to do with Mickey Mouse. It has something to do with the studios. And that's not it at all. And I still, I understand the connection, although I don't necessarily understand the reason why they would put the track length on the plaque as opposed to the original theater opening date in May of 27.
See, and I was confused about that in the beginning, too. It seemed to me that really came out of left field, you know. But the more that I studied Chinese theater there, I saw that Imagineers were putting in joke references all over the place. And as we go through the various scenes in the ride, I'll point out a couple that are maybe a little uncommon. But I think these guys had you know, maybe a can of Coors beer or something, and then, oh, yeah, that's hilarious, you know, as they go through some of that. But there's all these little Imagineering jokes in there, some that are evident, like in the alien scene where you have that computer at the bottom that's listing all of the names of the Imagineers, but it's also got, you know, all of those funny little expressions and hints and things like that nobody, they expected nobody would ever see, that there would never be digital cameras that were that fast or Disney fans that were that obsessive, you know, that would be looking at that. So I'm assuming the 1928 up there was some type of inside joke, because it's the exact length of the track, you know, for crying out loud. There's got to be something going on. But again, one of those little details on the outside that you miss.
And there's lots of them, you know, certainly. And I was surprised because I think it's a little bit more prominent than the alien. Usually people are cowering in the shoulders of who they're sitting next to when the alien used to pop out. But before we get into the attraction, you know, we're talking about the beauty of the pavilion. Another place, Jim, that I think it very much is lost on people who are rushing through, especially when the crowds are light, is in the interior queue, right? I think... And again, I'm a big proponent of stopping and looking up and looking around. From the carpeting to the ceiling to the beautiful murals on the wall, notwithstanding the display cases inside and the authentic movie memorabilia that's there, the theater queue before you get into that first sort of pre-show movie scene is beautiful.
You're absolutely right. And again, they're following that same lavishness of the original Grauman's Chinese theater. You know, a lot of that is authentically duplicated from that classic movie time period. And you're right, it's lush. And this is why these places were called movie palaces, you know? You just came in and it would be like stepping into the lobby of the Wilderness Lodge. It just takes your breath away. You know, there is nothing comparable in your life to prepare it to. And I also love the displays in those areas, and little did I suspect that those displays were going to be constantly changing. Mm-hmm. You know, I try to remind people, take pictures. You know, especially with the digital cameras where you can take, you know, 1,000 pictures in a second and you've still got enough room, you know, for 100,000 more. Take all of the because there were so many things... in those queue lines, that from the Vaz ruby slippers to, I remember they had the actual piano from Casablanca, which is one of my favorite films of all time. And I was surprised at how small it was, you know, because when you see it on screen, 40 feet tall, it's just overpowering. But, you know, you're absolutely right. And, you know, there are some secrets in that lobby. And so... if you're nice, a cast member may point out one or two things in the figures up above. And you probably don't realize, too, that that paneling right in front of you, just as you enter, if you pushed on it, you'd find it's actually a door where cast members can, you know, there's things back there.
I think you
didn't hear it. You didn't hear it on WDW radio.
I think what I'm going to quickly move to, before we get into sort of the theater queue with the films that are there. I think this is one of those places too, Jim, where the cast members, much like the Jungle Cruise, very much make the difference, right? From the cast members from the outside, who you can talk to and who really know their attraction very well, right? To the ones who are on the attraction themselves and can make or break it for you. And I remember being on the attraction maybe a year ago.
Well, I think every review you see on every site says the same thing. If you get a good cast member, this is a memorable, enhanced experience.
Right.
If you get a cast member who you can't understand clearly what they're saying, or they're you can tell when they're dragging, it just doesn't work. And the comparison with the Jungle Cruise is apt, except for one thing. On the Jungle Cruise, there is opportunities for limited ad-libbing. There isn't on the Great Movie Ride. And the reason for that is because of the way rights were signed off to some of those films or some of those actors. So there are certain things that you are required to say, and you can't say anything other than that about that particular moment or whatever. There is still some leeway, and I've had some cast members who have tossed in some movie facts that were great and really enhanced the experience, but their script is a lot more structured than the Jungle Cruise one, and I'm sorry about that, because I think if they had a little bit more freedom, because especially some of these kids working the ride, I'm sure are theater majors and would love to go crazy.
Well, when I was on a year ago, the person who was our cast member performed as though it was his first day on the job, and he was doing it for Bob Iger and every other Disney executive. And I got off the attraction, Jim, and I said, "Can I speak to a lead? Can I speak to a manager?"
What's wrong, Mr. Mongello? Mr. Mongello is upset. Please, get a manager here. Yes.
So the manager comes over, and she was very gracious, and she had that look like, "All right, I'm waiting for it." I says, "Listen, I want to say something about the cast member on the thing." And she sort of gave me that look like, "All right, here it comes." And I just said, "He was exceptional." Like, people who are listening need to go out of their way not to only talk about cast members when you're unhappy, but if somebody goes out of their way to make your experience better, you don't know how much it means to that cast member and that manager to hear. And I said, he was exceptional and gave me the best Great Movie Ride attraction experience I have ever had. I appreciate that.
Was this a gangster or was this a Western?
It was a gangster.
Okay.
It was a gangster, so
which is the most common nowadays.
Right. Yeah,
I think they only run the Western scene from about and don't hold me to this, but about 11 a.m. to maybe 2 or 3, and then on busy days,
right.
Bring that on. But if you ask, cast members will put you in the appropriate line for either gangster or Western scene. But
I think a lot of people, some people don't even realize that there are two separate scenes.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but you know, and you're talking about cast member. The funny thing about the Great Movie Ride is when they're in there, you know, you're in the tram, and the reason you're in a tram is it's recreating the experience of movie studios of taking a tram tour through the sets. You know, specifically Universal, except Universal is not represented anywhere in that attraction.
You keep speaking of this mythical place, Universal, that I've never even heard of before, but move on.
Well, that's what Michael Eisner claimed when Universal sued and said, well, he built Disney MGM Studios. He knew, by golly, where we were going to be building Universal Orlando, but that's another story. But the cast member in the tram, when he gets up there and he's welcoming you and all of that. This is the first time that a Disney cast member says, yes, this is the perfect job for me.
Hmm.
Not role. Go back and look at YouTube videos
next time
you're on there. Go take a look. But the script says, you know, I love the movies. This is the perfect job for me. Not role for me or whatever. I just thought I'd throw that in because... I'm Jim Korkus, and Jim Korkus is supposed to know these
things.
Jim
Korkus has a lot of free time on his hands.
Yeah.
All right, so wait, just quickly, before we get to the attraction, I'm going to tell you, one of the things I love is the pre-show. I love sort of the pre-show cue where you do the switchbacks, which really is sort of is meant to represent like a theater you would sit in, where they show those previews of the 8 different films before you get in. I like a lot.
Right? But Lou, I'm going to stop you here because Lou's written all these trivia books. Lou, what is the one trailer that is not shown in the preview, but there's a scene of it in the attraction?
The Searchers. No, wait, that's the one film that's shown, but it's not represented in the attraction. Right?
Because it's not shown in the trailer. All of those trailers there have elements that are represented in the attraction. The Searchers are even represented with John Wayne there. But there is a trailer missing for a major scene in the attraction.
Oh, so you're saying, I see what you're saying. One of the scenes is not shown.
Okay, yeah, there's a trailer that's missing to represent one of the major scenes in the attraction. And people at home are yelling at you.
Wizard of Oz.
Where are the Fox people when we need them?
Wizard of Oz.
Wizard of Oz.
Wizard of Oz, yep.
And we'll get to be talking about that, but yeah, it has to do with number of minutes you can see Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, people don't realize, and that's sort of going back to, working with MGM, not just for the name, but for the rights to the films. You know, obviously you can tell the story about how Wizard of Oz was really, it was done on a minute-by-minute basis, and that's why the scenes are what they are, but we'll get to that as we get to it.
Right.
All right, so
and if we don't get to it on this show because we love to talk, we'll get to it in the second part. Go ahead.
All right, so let's sort of take it scene by scene, and right, you kick it off with a film that I could pretty much promise that 95% of the people who are in the attraction, if not more, have never seen, cannot identify, and have probably never heard a Footlight Parade with James Cagney.
Right. Now, before we get there, I also want to point out, and you didn't hear this on WDW Radio, but when you're on the tram, right before you go underneath the marquee, because you're going into the movies, that's why there's no track. They're using that same technology they use in Universe of Energy, where there's a wire, you know, in the concrete there, and the tram is following that wire. That's why you don't have to worry that, you know, your cast member there is not paying attention to move the wheel on the car. But right as you go underneath the marquee, of course, there's a sign saying Hollywood and Vine. So you're going down Hollywood Boulevard here. Over to the right, that is the section where in the safe they keep the blank guns. Because safety is the number one thing at Disney, and so gangsters and the cowboys and cowgirls who, you know, I guess there's only a cowgirl, use the blank guns. They have to go through training. They have to be checked out. And the guns, they have to sign out the gun, so there's no playing around and all that. And it's right in those safes, right there to the right. And I point that out so when the zombie apocalypse comes and you need a gun.
That's not where you want to go to get it.
Great movie ride. That's where you should be going.
You don't need to.
So we're going to Footlight Parade.
Footlight Parade, right.
And you're making me sad with Footlight Parade.
And here, I think we're sad for the same reasons, because you and I have, and because we're getting older, our memories are getting vaguer, but we recall when that beautiful pyramid of women, right, had the bubbles come down, and it moved. And I say this, that it used to move all the time.
And not only did it move, but the bottom tier moved clockwise, and then the one on top of that moved counterclockwise accordingly, all the way up there. So these are twirling, and there is water coming out, spraying out from that. And you have women mannequins up there on diving boards, rather, you know, ready to dive in. And now Footlight Parade has become the disco yeti of the great movie ride. You put down this scrim and you put on a couple of images on it and you try and twirl them, and see, it looks like it's really moving if you squint your eyes and turn your head to the left. But again, what was happening is the mechanism was very heavy, and so they were constantly having problems with that. And also the water, and you would think they would have accounted for this, was getting into the tracks and flooding the tracks.
Yeah, water and electronics don't mix very well.
No. And, and especially when the water's even, you know, bashing up against the tram there, and, you know, you're worried about, okay, is this going to affect the connection underneath? And to make things worse, because we're getting to that next scene with Singing in the Rain, the umbrella used to be open, mm-hmm. but Footlight Parade couldn't keep water in their own scene. It was going out, and it was hitting this open umbrella, and it was splattering onto people in the tram. Not a good thing. Splash Mountain in Great. Yeah. That's why we love Great Movie Ride. It has all of those elements. It has that Expedition Everest Disco Yeti element. It's got the Splash Mountain element here. Yeah. But yes, Footlight Parade was a magnificent way of entering into the chronology of movie cinema, but also a very cool, if you weren't familiar with the film, a very cool physical kinetic thing to see. And it was like, oh my gosh, I can hardly wait for what's next. Now it's dead.
Well, it's one of those things, like the Yeti, if you didn't know it was broken, you don't know it's broken. Right? You know, because I have people
I guess that's true. If I see a Yeti, I'm always suspicious it's going to move.
Just look at the blinking strobes and move on.
Yes.
So, all right, so let's move on to Singing in the Rain, Gene Kelly, 1952. Gene Kelly, the audio animatronic, like all the celebrities who have sort of audio animatronic cameos, he mm-hmm. inspected his animatronic before, like you said,
he had to approve because, again, he was alive, and you have to realize, and as we get it through the attraction, we'll talk more about this, that these people have estates, and estates have to sign off that, yes, you know, that person can be represented in that way, and it's caused some interesting things in the attraction itself. Gene Kelly was still alive, but the Imagineers know that actors are very vain, you know. They think they look better than they actually do, or they're more sensitive to aspects like a large ear or whatever. So before they took Gene Kelly in there to approve the figure, they took him out for drinks. Now there's some debate about how many drinks, but the bottom line was when they took him in and he saw that, he'd say, oh, well, that's fine. And a lot of people don't realize that in the movie itself, they're not using water. Mm-hmm. They're using milk so it can be seen on film.
Right.
You know, so that's very interesting. And again, water was splashing off of this, so now he's got it, folded up in his hands. But again, I wonder how many kids today watch Singing in the Rain, or if they watch Singing in the Rain, they go, well, that's a ripoff of that movie, The Artist.
Right, or they see the umbrella at Hollywood Studios outside on the streets of America and go, oh, that's that scene from the Great Movie Ride. Yeah, I know where that's from.
Yeah, yeah.
But you finally get to Mary Poppins, and this is the one that I think, Jim, that is so iconic. However old it may be, everybody knows it. Everybody knows the music. It's immediately identifiable.
I would say for the most part, yes. You know, as we talked about earlier, next year it's hitting its 50th birthday, though. So it. But again, I think thanks to the Broadway musical, you know, it's still fresh. As well, and again, I think very, very clever of how, you know, Mary rises up and back down. It took me a couple of rides to try and figure out, because you look behind the Mary Poppins figure and there's nothing, you know, and there's no wires, there's no, you know, so you have to, oh, that's how they, oh my gosh, but even when you know, you still go, how do they do that? How do they do that? You know? So I think, and who doesn't love hearing Julie Andrews sing, right?
Right. Well, so let's sort of just quickly stop. We'll stop the tram for a second, and let's take these three films together. Footlight Parade, Singing in the Rain, Mary Poppins, representing the musical genre, right?
Yes. And not only the musical genre, but the development of the musical genre.
Right.
The development from the 30s and 40s with Busby Berkeley, you know, to now you're getting into, you know, the 50s and 60s with a Gene Kelly, and then into the mid-60s and beyond with Mary Poppins. So, yeah, what a great way to start a show.
And when we start to think about updates, you know, do those three films change? Look, I'm not saying to put High School Musical in, right? You know, but
High School what? Does anybody still talk about? Does anybody still talk about that? You know, isn't it Wet Night Story or Wet Beach Party? I don't even know the title.
Yeah, the new beach. But so, what are the new? You know, what are the more relevant musicals, right? I still think, look, I'm a child of the 80s. Grease is the first one that comes to mind,
mm-hmm.
right? It's, you know, from stage to screen, everybody kind of knows Grease. Everybody knows Mary Poppins.
Would you put Chicago in there? Chicago won all those awards, both on stage and at the Oscars, but is that an iconic enough
right.
image?
Everybody knows Grease Lightning. I cannot tell you a song. I literally cannot tell you a song from Chicago.
Okay.
Fair
enough. But again, that's the same conundrum that faced the Imagineers. You know, when you make a choice, you've got to make that choice based on, my gosh, you know, what is the quality of this? What are the memories that it's going to generate for guests who are seeing this, you know, in addition to, you know, can we get the rights to this? Can we afford this? Whatever. But just on the very basic level, what musicals would you include in there? Because again, they didn't pick Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers,
right.
You know, they didn't pick Sound of Music.
Right, I was gonna say, Sound of Music was maybe the only one, you know, relatively recent. I mean, but that's how, you know, again, how modern is it?
Mm-hmm. You know, so a good call, you know, and in fact, are there good movie musicals out there within the last 10 years? That people would, oh my gosh, yes, Footloose. Would you put Footloose in there?
yeah.
Kevin Bacon. So the audio animatronics would have 7 degrees of separation from a Kevin Bacon audio animatronic. That would work. Okay.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of ones in the last couple of years. You know,
Newsies?
Les Mis, maybe, you know, I'm trying to think.
Les Mis, yeah. But again, I don't know whether some of these would have that same
right.
impact,
that
emotional
right.
impact. You know, if Footlight Parade, I still, even though it's broken, I still get an emotional impact from it because, for me, it represents all of those musical films in the 30s and early 40s. And Singing in the Rain is one of my favorite films of all time. I can watch it over and over and over. And, of course, Mary Poppins is wonderful. And for those of you in the Detroit, Michigan area, this weekend, while Lou is off enjoying himself in Alani with Hula Girl.
I'm working.
I'll be up in Detroit, Michigan. They have an old restored movie palace called the Redford Theater that is just opening this weekend, and they are showing 3 screenings of Mary Poppins, and I'm going to be talking you know, about the making of Mary Poppins, and of course some of those famous Jim Corcus. Where did he ever find out that story?
But
any of you are in the Detroit area, it's only $5. They're only charging $5, and money is going to the Michigan Make-A-Wish Foundation.
All right, real quick, before we leave the musicals, I'm going to show what a total dork I am and child of the 80s. Fame.
Okay.
You're like, what? That's the only other musical I could think of. So my three are Fame, Grease, and Mary Poppins.
We'll see what your listeners contribute, because they are a lot smarter than the two of us put together.
I have a feeling they probably wouldn't consider the Blues Brothers or Purple Rain, Break Into, Electric Boogaloo, or Blazing Saddles to be musicals. So.
Are you pulling something up on Google here right now?
No, I'm thinking back. I'm like, okay, what other movies did I listen to that I actually own soundtrack? I mean, not that I own the soundtrack for Blazing Saddles, but it's a musical.
And again, I think the key point, too, is do you walk out of the movie singing that song or whistling that song? You know?
The Blues Brothers, yes. I actually did the same thing for Fame, but... And I own Purple Rain on anyway.
You know, sometime for one of your meet and greets, we should probably dress up as the Blues Brothers.
We could do that.
I don't know how we would work that as a Disney connection, but you have so many meet and greets, and you can have a karaoke contest there with that. So anyway,
all right, let's go.
We're out of the musicals.
We're out of the musicals into the underworld, and this is the one where you know the character. Right, you sort of know the Cagney Robinson characters, but how many people
Humphrey
know
Humphrey Bogart? Don't leave out Humphrey Bogart.
Right, but how many people know the films? Right, Public Enemy and Little Caesar.
Mm-hmm. Well, what you say is we've gone through the musicals, which is an important film genre, especially in the 40s, and now we're going into gangster films. And of course, this was the realm of Warner Brothers. And Warner Brothers really had a lock on doing gangster films. And yes, there are references in here, very strong references to a James Cagney movie and called Public Enemy. And in fact, you'll see some of those buildings there, the Patrick J. Ryan bar. Right. That's a bar that gets blown up in the film. And U Drive Garage, that's part of that as well. And Cagney standing out in front of... Red Oak Social Club. That's a scene from the movie with one major difference. That is not the outfit that Cagney was wearing in the movie. His estate, his family, would not sign off until they put him in a tux because they wanted people to come through and see James Cagney looking good, not like a gangster.
Right.
So he's in a tux, but not as he is in the movie. But there's other elements in there, too. There's the red and blue cab company. If you look at that, that's from a movie with Cagney and Humphrey Bogart called Roaring Twenties. But again, they're all Warner's films. But again, here's detail that you're missing. As you're going through there, you're waiting to see Cagney or you're listening to... You're not looking over to the left. Mm-hmm. Right before Patrick J. Ryan's bar, if you take a look, there's... these glycerin puddles on the ground, and there's a newspaper over there, too, that's got a headline and got stories, and nobody takes a picture of that. Nobody takes a picture of some of these other little items. And then one of the things that bothers me about the gangster scene is, just like the Haunted Mansion, this is one of the ones where cast members have tried to impose themselves into the scene. And so... you had a cast member who put a hidden Mickey up in the warehouse window, and they kept taking it down, and he kept coming in. Even on his days off, he kept coming in the morning to put it up there until he finally wore them down. So Imagineers came up with a hidden Mickey up there. But, you know, I don't necessarily think that cast members should impose themselves on an attraction, you know,
right.
Like at the Haunted Mansion. Well, that ring was... you know, thrown there by the husband. No, it wasn't. No, it wasn't. Don't tell people that. And Yale Gracie is the owner of the mansion. No, he isn't. Don't tell people that. But you tell that story over and over and over, and it becomes the truth. When they do the rehab of the Haunted Mansion, they actually put a ring down there. Right. They do the movie, and Yale Gracie is the lord of the manor, and that was not the intent. You know, I'm getting out my grumpy old man cane, waving it in the air, venting. But there's other things about the gangster scene. Talk about some of these, Lou.
Well, so before I want to talk about the gangster scene, let's sort of talk about updates, right? Is this one that does it stay? Is this the representation of the gangster genre?
I'd put in Godfather.
How do you not put in Godfather? Not three, because it doesn't really count. Like the second Star Wars trilogy, it doesn't count. You put in Godfather 1 and 2, mm-hmm. right? It is the godfather of Godfather movies.
See, if it wasn't a TV show, I'd say, you know, Sopranos and have a James Gandolfini audio animatronic in
Goodfellas,
there.
Scarface.
I think Godfather is the iconic go-to gangster film now for everyone. You know, I was thinking, well, maybe Scarface with Al Pacino, and you know, I still think Godfather would have that moodiness mm-hmm. in there too, and you could do some frightening aspects in there.
Yeah, and it's, you know, how you represent those films. You know, if you look in the scenes here in the underworld, there's nothing violent about it, right? You sort of have to pick these scenes.
What, you got a car coming out shooting people shooting at you? No, that's not violent at all.
I mean the representations.
No, that's
the representation
just nitrogen in there
of,
that's coming out at you.
Listen to me. I mean the representation of the actors and the scenes from the movies, the specific scenes from, like, you know, Public Enemy with James Cagney. He's just sort of standing there looking very ominous, but he himself, the animatronic, is not. It's not a representation of a violent scene. Certainly what you do when we get through.
See, I'd have a scene of Marlon Brando behind the desk, but
that's right.
Ray. So as you come in, you can just see that face, and maybe even you have some figures surrounding and facing him, so you can, you know, get that sense of
you feel like you're in that room, right? You feel like you're sitting in that room with him, right? Right.
Mm-hmm. So, well, that's what else are we going to say about the gangster scene here? Because there's a lot in there. People talk about it all the time. You know, you've got those two audio animatronic gangsters that pop up. They're actually reused audio animatronics from Pirates of the Caribbean. Although in this scene, they're called Squint and Bean.
Mm-hmm.
See, and I've got to figure, this is the Imagineers having fun. There is no gangster movie ever, because I've seen a lot of them, and especially from the 30s and 40s, where there's Squint and Bean.
Squint is not a very tough name. Like, you would have got beaten up in high school if your nickname was Squint. You wouldn't be.
Were you the one doing the beating up?
You know, the bandits in the band, we'll get to the bandits, but they have more, you know, those are true sort of bandit, western-y kind of names. At least Muggsy, all right, it has that feeling from the 30s, but Squint? Bean? No, I'm not intimidated.
Well, and again, the Great Movie Ride has really been fairly well documented, you know, especially on the internet, but everybody brings up the things over the time, but for those who are not familiar, the license plate on the car is 021429, which is February 14th, 1929, which was the St. Valentine's Day massacre in Chicago, and yes, those guns are not shooting blanks and all of that. That's literally, you know, nitrogen and a mixture of things coming out, so, you know, no tram riders are hurt on this on this experience. And yes, this is what is considered the A version of the ride, mm-hmm. where you have a real live gangster, Muggsy, come out.
Right, and originally, wasn't it that only, I'm going to make sure I get this right, males were the gangsters and females were bandits, right? And now there are female Muggsies.
And for those of you who are keeping track for the multiple choice quiz,
if you're keeping
coming
score
at the end
home.
Of the show, it was 2000 where you got the first girl gangster. And you also got the first male cowboy. You know, because basically what it was the males would play the gangster and the female would play Kate, and I can't remember the name offhand right now, in the Western scene. But, yep, times, they are a-changing. So in 2000, you have a girl, but she's still called Muggsy.
With an
eye. But when a girl plays the part, It's an I instead of a Y at the end of the name.
Right. And it's Kate Durango. Carson.
That's why I do these shows with you, is you represent the brain cells in my head that are dying every day, you know, so you're recovering that. Now, you know, we've been talking about this for an hour. Do you think this is going to be another two-part show that we should wrap up now and have people tune in next week wearing their WDW radio t-shirts?
Jim, you are my brother from another mother because you read my mind, right? I think this is appropriate because I want to make sure we give the rest of the attraction and our discussion its due, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what I want to know from listeners up to this point is, let's talk about those first two scenes, right? Those first two genres, the musicals and the gangsters. If you are an Imagineer, you've got unlimited budget. Let's forget about the legal rights and ramifications and wranglings. What films do you put in to accurately represent the movie musical and the gangster film? You can post on the Facebook page over at facebook.com/WDW Radio. You can tweet me at Lou Mangiello or come by the show notes over at WDWRadio.com. Click on this week's podcast. Leave your answer in the comment section. Jim and I will be checking that as well. We'll leave our thoughts in there too. And then tune in next week for the second part and also find out why we're deciding to cover the Great Movie Ride right now and how you can be a part of the movies.
How you can be in the movie
exactly.
With Lou Mangiello.
Exactly. We'll sort of just tease it and let that go. But what I want you to do in the meantime, after you're done listening to the show and leaving your comments, is I do want you to go back to the show notes because there I'm going to put links to Jim Corcus's library, litany of books, Who's Afraid of Song of the South, The Revised Vault of Walt, lots of great stuff. Again, the only place you can find the stories that you cannot hear anywhere else. And Jim, you know I'm a big fan, especially of the Vault of Walt series and Song of the South. So people should definitely go and check them out. They're in print. They're on the Kindle. They're on the iBook, whatever your iDevice is, you can get it there too.
Lou, you're a wonderful friend, and I've always loved your audience, and I always love meeting them in person as well. So, folks, we always intend for these to just be one-off shows. We really do, but we just get so excited, and we want you to have all of this material and to have accurate material out there. Both Lou and I do extensive research before we get together to do these things. It's not just off the top of our heads. So thank you for being so supportive of WDW Radio, and tune in next week for a thrilling adventure from yesteryear.
Dun, dun, dun. It's time for our Walt Disney World Trivia Question of the Week, where I ask you to test your knowledge of Walt Disney World history, see how well you pay attention to the details and what you see, or maybe even what you hear, and then randomly select one winner from all the correct entries for a chance to win a Disney prize package. Before we get to this week's question, let's go back, review last week's, and select our winner. So last week, I was talking about how so many things in Walt Disney World are overlooked, from the smallest details and stories to even some major attractions, and one of them is actually the magic of Disney animation. In this interactive presentation, you are taught the basics of creating an animated character and the importance of character development in Disney movies, and actually get to try your hand using the Disney animator's instructions at creating your own Disney animated character. Great free souvenir you can take home as well. And so my question to you last week was very simple. Was during that segment called Drawn to Animation, where the artist teaches you about drawing some of the Disney characters, you're taught about the importance of character development by one of Disney's famous animated characters himself. So your question last week was simply, who was it? Who is that Disney animated character that joins you in the Drawn to Animation section? And again, the hundreds of you that answered correctly, and it is, of course, Mushu from Mulan. And a little bit of extra trivia. Now, while Eddie Murphy did the voice of Mushu in the Mulan film, voice artist Mark Moseley provides the voice of Mushu in the attraction. So again, thanks to all of you who entered. I randomly selected one winner from all the correct entries, and this week's winner, who gets All six of my virtual audio walking tours of the Magic Kingdom, a WDW Radio luggage tag, button, and a signed copy of my Walt Disney World trivia book and a mystery ticket is Judy Keller. So Judy, congratulations. I'll get your prize package out to you right away. If you played last week and didn't win, thanks so much for entering, but don't worry, because here's your next chance to enter in this week's Walt Disney World Trivia Challenge. So as long as we're talking about the Great Movie Ride, let's stay with the Great Movie Ride. And on the attraction, your cast member takes you through the various scenes and genres as if you are on a real backlot studio tour. And along the way, he or she tells you what his or her favorite of the many genres you experience is. So tell me, according to that script, which doesn't change, what is your tour guide's favorite genre? Is it the Western, sci-fi, horror, musical, maybe one of the other ones? You tell me. You have until Sunday, July 14th at 11:59 p.m. Eastern to email your answer to contest@wdwradio.com. You'll be playing for all the audio tours, a luggage tag, button, and a WDW Radio t-shirt. So good luck and have fun. That's going to do it for this week's show. Thanks so much for taking the time and tuning in this and every week. Be sure and tune in next week for part two of our DSI of the Great Movie Ride. Also, be sure and stay tuned to this week's WDW Radio Live newscast, Wednesday at 7:30 over at WDW Radio Live. I'm going to have information about our upcoming e-ticket event weekend and why it ties into the Great Movie Ride. If you don't catch it live this or every week, you'd also catch the audio in our iTunes feed, the video on the YouTube channel, and on the WDW Radio blog. Speaking of the website, be sure and visit wdwradio.com. We have multiple blog posts every day, including Self-Shot Tuesdays, photo contests, lots more. We also have new videos, including my new Disney in a Minute video series, where each week I take you throughout the Walt Disney World theme parks and resorts, and in about 60 seconds time, I introduce you to some of the hidden treasures, overlooked experiences, and tips and tricks to get the most out of your Walt Disney World vacation. Again, you can find it on the blog, in the iTunes feed, which you can subscribe to in iTunes, or by subscribing to my YouTube channel at youtube.com/WDW Radio. Also, while you're there, be sure and sign up for our new free weekly email newsletter for exclusive content, contests, deals, information updates, and lots more. You can also download the free WDW Radio app for your iPhone and Android device. You can find and contact me on Twitter. I'm at Lou Mangiello, facebook.com/Lou Mangiello. You can subscribe to my page there. You can also call the voicemail. Be heard on the air at 407-900-9391 with a question, comment, or just a hello from the parks. Or if you have a question you want answered on the show, email me at lou@wdwradio.com. But in addition to connecting with you virtually, nothing beats a handshake and a hug. And that's why we have a number of live events in and out of Walt Disney World. You can visit the events page over at wdwradio.com for more information. And our next meet of the month in Walt Disney World is going to be Saturday, July 27th at 9:30 a.m. Join us for breakfast on the boardwalk. I thought this month we would have a meet outside the park. So if you don't have a park ticket or you're blacked out, you can join us on the boardwalk from 9:30 to 11 a.m. You can grab a coffee, some breakfast, and join with us over at the seating area by the water. Again, park admission not required. Hope you can join us there. You can find more information about the event on the events page and our Facebook events page as well, too. And speaking of events not in Walt Disney World, our next on-the-road event is next week at Disney's Aulani Resort in Hawaii. I'll be out there for a week with some WDW Radio listeners, and I'll be broadcasting live from the resort on Wednesday, July 17th at 7:30 p.m. Eastern at wdwradiolive.com. I'll also have updates via Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. Great way to sort of share our experience there. Hope you can join us live, watch, and be part of the conversation as well. I want to say quickly thank you to my partners and sponsors, including Mouse Fan Travel, who's joining us out in Aulani next week. Whether you're going to Aulani or Disney World or Land or any Disney destination, Becky and her team give you the best possible prices, all available discounts, all with an incredible level of personal service. It's who I use, and that's a big reason why. You can visit them over at mousefantravel.com. And if you can't get to the parks as often as you like, and really, who can, you can get some magic delivered to you right at home or your digital device by subscribing to order back issues of Celebrations Magazine, celebrating its five-year anniversary this year over at celebrationspress.com. And as always, my friends, and you are my friends, whether we have met yet or not, all I ask is that if you like the show, please help spread the word, let others know about it, tweet out that you're listening, come by, comment, and share links to your favorite episodes over on Facebook, and please come by, rate and review the show and the app over on iTunes. It's very, very helpful and very much appreciated. And most importantly, I want to say thank you to each and every one of you for taking the time to tune in and connect with me online or send me emails and for letting me do what I love and share my passion for Disney with you each and every day in so many different ways. I'm incredibly grateful, and I want you to do the same thing. I want you to do what you love each and every day. So remember that while you can't go back in time and create a new beginning, you can start today and make a new ending to your life. Have faith. Always keep moving forward and do what you love each and every day. Have a great week, everybody. Thanks so much again for listening. So until next time, see ya.
Uncle Orville lives. Hi, this is Ken from Philadelphia. I've been listening to your show for ages, it seems. I've called a few times, but I just... here teaching at, I'm a professor at Drexel University. I just was talking to a guy who was behind his coffee cart here in 95 degree heat, and he just had his fan on only. And I said, why not an air conditioner? He goes, it won't work, you know, with the window open here and our generator won't take it. And I said, you know what I think might work? Just get like a big bag of ice or a big bucket of ice from the 7-Eleven there and put it in front of your fan and let it run. And it might just work, thanks to Uncle Orville's ingenuity. And today I walked in and there he is with his ice in front of his fan. And he thanked me very much and I got myself a free cup of coffee from it. Thank you, Uncle Orville. And thank you, Lou Mangiello. Take care, bye.
Hey, Lou. Wesley Snyder calling. I had this crazy idea to go to Disney for 365 consecutive days. I've always kind of wanted to do it. I always thought, oh, someday maybe I'll retire and I'll head down there. Well, I just spoke with my wife and I said, what if we did it now? We have a daughter who's not yet in school. We have another one on the way in a couple of months. So what if we did it now? What do you think? And she said, sure. So we're going to maybe try a Kickstarter or some way of earning some money, raising some money for it. And then if we can get enough money to cover our bills for a year, we are going to move to Orlando. And I will make a point of going to Disney every single day for 365 days. Hot, cold, sunny, rainy, hurricanes, I will be there if we can raise enough money. So it's just gone from a dream to a, let's actually check this out and see if it's doable, to a, now let's see if we can work it. So I'd share with you, if this was to happen, I'd see you at least a dozen times at some meetups. Have a good one. Bye-bye. You've got a friend.